My name is Jackie Brolsma, and I have worked in the field of alcoholism and chemical dependency treatment for about the last 12 and a half years in a variety of settings, both with individuals and with families and with children, both in hospital-based type programs as well as outpatient clinic type facilities as well. And I don't come from an alcoholic family, but I think you'll hear me share some things about my own family in this session, just because I believe that the way that families survive alcoholism or chemical dependency is, in some ways it's unique, but in other ways it's very similar to how we see families deal with any other kind of crisis. And the information that I share this morning will also, you may find yourself relating it to your own family, even though you may not have grown up in an alcoholic family. There are often many similarities. Some people, you know, worry about someone they care about who smokes too much marijuana or smokes too much pot. Others worry about someone who's taking prescription pills, perhaps. Others worry about somebody who drinks too much alcohol. The common bond between all of those, pills, pot, alcohol, whatever, is that each substance really has the potential to develop in the person harmful chemical dependency. And I'll use the words chemical dependency and alcoholism interchangeably just because we don't really have enough words to describe all the possible addictions. As you've maybe heard me say in other classes, we would be saying Valiumism, marijuanaism, cocainism, morphinism, and so rather than, or moneyism, or any of the kind of addictive kind of behaviors. And I use them all and lump them under the umbrella of chemical dependency, and we'll use that term probably in synonymous with alcoholism. Chemical dependency can become a physical addiction, but it doesn't necessarily. In fact, by far the majority of people who suffer from chemical dependency are not physically dependent on the substance that they use. They may be only emotionally dependent or psychologically dependent on them. Physical addiction is often a later stage symptom. A lot of people think that to be chemically dependent, you have to be physically addicted. In other words, unable to go without it. And that's really not the case. Addiction brings self-destruction, certainly, to the person who is abusing or who is dependent on the substances, and it brings what we call other destruction to those around that person. And those usually are in the form of negative and emotionally painful experiences. The systems that are usually most affected by somebody who is chemically dependent or alcoholic are, of course, the family, work settings, school systems, and friends. And what I say about families this morning applies equally well with other systems that I mentioned. And what I want to talk about is really the ways in these systems that people react to the behavior of the person who's chemically dependent and how they adjust and shift and allow their own lives to be affected by their emotional involvement with someone who's chemically dependent. And if you write nothing else down, what I appreciate you going away from here remembering is that no one escapes from a chemically dependent family. No one escapes living in that situation without some sort of pain or consequence. Even though perhaps the child didn't grow up while the person was using alcohol or maybe didn't live in the home, the dynamics were still there nonetheless. So if you remember nothing else, I'd like you to remember that. There are some common, well, maybe first of all, I don't know about you, but when I first started to work with families, my first tendency was to maybe look at a family, and when a family was having trouble, try to figure out who it was in the family that was causing all the trouble.
One person.
You know, right. Maybe if that person got taken care of, the family would be okay. We all have a tendency to do that. Sometimes in relationships, when divorce comes to a marriage, we might try to figure out who's to cause or who's the one that's, responsible for it all. And we think that maybe once we've solved the problems of that individual, then there would be no complaints. The family would be just fine. And sometimes parents look that way at their children when one of their children get into trouble in school or whatever, is just go fix Johnny. Everything will be all right. And very often, children in that kind of situation are really expressing some sort of problem that's within the whole family, not just with one individual. And so it would kind of be analogous to treating medically all the physical symptoms that a person has in a patient, and then upon completion saying, well, they must be healthy once we've gotten rid of all the symptoms. Health is something different from just the absence of illness, so to speak. And chemical dependency in one family member is really not not just one of the many problems in this family. We say that chemical dependency is a family illness and a primary disease within each family member. Now, when I say that, I think that will have more meaning after I show some of the ways in the survival role. And the working of the family has a pathology about it that is directly related to the sickness of a chemically dependent person. In other words, rather than just kind of listing ingenious ways of trying to get rid of the chemical dependency from the family, we have to really kind of look at the dynamics of the whole family. And the family is affected greatly by the chemically dependent person. Their relationship the person has to the mood-altering drugs, the chemically dependent, contributes to the family illness greatly. Obviously, if you're involved with somebody who's on mood-altering substances that are physically affecting their body, that's certainly going to have its effect on the people who are involved with them. The chemically dependent person, on the other hand, is also greatly affected by how those people try to deal with it. And that's probably a little more the focus of what I'll talk about. Kind of to understand the dynamics or the phenomena of chemical dependency happening in a family, we kind of have to look at what a family is. And usually for this lecture, I like to bring in a mobile and to kind of compare a family in some ways to a mobile, in that family is really like an organism and it has all these separate parts to it. The members of the family operate, kind of like an engine maybe in some ways. And a system is a body of parts that work together. And they might work together for peace and harmony, and they may work together for destruction. And they may work together just to survive, nothing more than that. And a family really resembles a mobile in that a mobile is really an art form. I kind of often wish this was one, but it's not really a mobile because they're really not all connected. But if you think of the mobiles that have like rods and string attached to them, the beauty lies in the way that the mobile is able to kind of shift and move. When a current of air comes into a room, what does a mobile do but sort of, move with that current of air and shift? And really, what is a mobile always trying to do? To get balanced, right? To get stable or to balance. And the beauty lies in the way that it's able to shift and able to move and able to do that. And the mobile has a way of responding to changing that, like wind or whatever, it changes its position, but it always is always connected still, right? It's always still connected. It's not possible for me to sort of pull on one part of the mobile and not have the rest of the mobile shift and change, right? If I pull on one section, what happens to it? Kind of all, goes like this, trying to get balanced again. And the same thing is true of a family. When there's a great deal of stress, what happens is the whole organism or the whole family shifts to bring about balance again in the family. Now, sometimes that happens temporarily when there's a death in a family. People may pick up the slack for other people who are not able, everybody dealing with it very differently. And eventually, maybe the family kind of falls back into its normal pattern. When there's prolonged stress, such as alcoholism or maybe a chronic illness like cancer, perhaps depression, maybe even diabetes or some kind of paralyzing life situation, then the dynamics are maybe a little more permanent in the sense that people get locked into certain ways that they try to keep that balance in the family. And really that's that balance or that strive for stability is something we all enter into when we come into a family, you know, regardless of whether it's a healthy family or a dysfunctional one. And I like to tell people, like sometimes when we look at families, we go, God, I can't figure out why they're doing that. You know, why does she put up with that? Or why are they behaving that way? Why don't they kick them out? Or why don't they do this? Or why don't they do that? And what I like to say is that really everybody in the family is really doing the best they can with what they know at any particular point in time. It's hard for us to believe that sometimes, but everybody's really doing the best they can with what they know at that particular point in time. And sometimes that's really been a way that's helped me understand some of the hurt and some of the pain that went on in the family when I'd get angry about maybe the way a situation was handled. That they were really doing whatever they could to produce the least amount of stress for themselves. And just as a chemically dependent person begins to suffer a lot of self-delusion in not being able to see what's happening to them, obviously that's the frustration we feel, can't they see it? So does the family suffer a great deal of delusion in terms of what's really happening. They have a lot of denial as well. So they consequently, you know, start to repress and to not be in touch with their own feelings as well. There are some characteristics that whether you're the chemically dependent person or a family member, everybody experiences, and they're basically five. The first one is denial and delusion, which I already touched on. And your first response might be to say, well, gosh, certainly the person who's alcoholic, they're deluded. Because every time we try to talk to them, they say, oh, no, it's not that bad. I can handle it. No problem. And we certainly see their denial real clearly. But the family also participates in that. As you might have heard in another class when I talk about the big elephant that's in the middle of the room, and everybody knows that it's there. Everybody knows there's a problem, but we never talk about it. We pretend it's not there. We maybe even clean up after it. We walk around it. And sometimes family members will describe it as, well, what kind of shape is Dad in today? Is he sick or is he well? We never say what it is. And so there's a lot of delusion and denial. And very often when people come up and approach the spouse or the parent of somebody who's chemically dependent and ask them how the family is, what kind of response do they usually give?
Oh, everything's fine.
Everything's okay. Everything's just fine. And they maybe smile right through that. They participate in the denial in the same way that the chemically dependent person does. Nobody wants to face up to it. And so there develops a real rule in the family, which is don't talk about it. A no-talk rule, we say. The second one is, which one do I want to use next? The next one is compulsive behavior. And once again, you might say, well, certainly the person's use of alcohol or the substances is certainly compulsive. Compulsive in the sense that they're driven to keep trying to do it. But everybody participates in some compulsive behavior because it becomes the rule in the family that people feel more and more like they don't have a choice, like they have to just do certain things. And oftentimes this compulsive behavior might take the form of compulsive work, obsessed with cleaning, keeping things neat, tidy all of the time. It might be compulsive overeating or spending, or compulsive perfectionism, like sometimes older children feel driven to perform in school and to get only high grades and to do things perfectly in school. It might be compulsive undereating to the point of anorexia, or you know, a compulsion to always be neat and exactly tidy and every hair in place. Compulsion and maybe compulsive gambling. Even religion can become compulsive sometimes for family members, finding their only security in that and feeling driven to just sort of totally, I guess there's a book that's out that I'm really curious to read sometimes, talking about the difference between being called and being driven. And I think sometimes when religion becomes a compulsion, it's more of being driven than being called in their own particular ministry. So compulsive behavior is another one that we see in everybody in the family. Naturally, if all of this delusion and denial is going on, nobody's going to feel very good about themselves and what's happening to the family. So consequently, there's a lot of low self-worth. I feel ashamed. I feel like maybe it's my fault, which is often the case for the children and spouse. And so a lot of shame and low self-worth. Children may be feeling like they don't want to bring anybody home from school, don't want to bring friends because they don't know what kind of situation the household will be in. Unable to talk about what's going on in the family means that people keep all those feelings on the inside. And so there's a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. The fourth one related to that is frozen emotions or feelings. And you might say, well, if the alcoholic, once again, is using mood-altering substances, of course they're not allowing themselves to feel, right? All their emotions that get expressed are drug-affected, usually. You know, they're affected by a chemical. But what about the family? And sometimes I think, you know, when people are still advocating treatment for family, I sometimes like to say and tell people that at least the chemically dependent person had some substances for them to get through the pain that was going on. Family members don't even have that. And the pain for them sometimes is even more raw and more unbearable. And so consequently, I don't know about you, but I'd want to freeze my emotions too. And it's sort of like people in a family literally put their feelings in the icebox. And if you've ever been a part of, like, sometimes when death comes to a family, that's a kind of an event that sometimes allows people to share their feelings for some reason. Death means we're more willing to just kind of put ourselves out there. And I can remember a few years ago going back from my grandfather's funeral, and he was one person who was particularly important in our family because my father suffered chronic depression, and so my grandfather was there often a lot as a father, kind of alternatively. And so he's a pretty special guy. And anyway, we were all sitting around the table talking the way you do after, you know, a funeral and you're mourning and grieving together. And all of a sudden, my sister starts telling me about some things that she was really angry about that happened like probably 15 years ago. And for some reason, she felt freer in that situation to begin to share some feelings. And it was literally like the dam had kind of been released. In a healthy family, if people are sharing those feelings as they go along, there's no need to store them up. And, you know, it's unfortunate that she had to hang on to those feelings. I mean, we could have resolved it 15 years ago, you know, but the rules were not such in our family that it wasn't okay, really, to talk about feelings in that sense. When families go in for treatment, very often they say and they talk about the fact that in many ways it feels kind of like they're thawing out. That somehow they're feeling a life inside of themselves that they never felt before. Feelings that they didn't even know that they had.
Do you consider that depression, frozen emotions?
Yeah, very much so. And depression is a common, response for codependence.
Yeah.
Definitely. Because that's what depression literally means. It's depressing emotions. And it's anger turned inward at self. So, frozen feelings. And then the last one is health or medical problems. Now, once again, you might say, well, gee, the chemically dependent person, the person who's using the substances, they're certainly going to have health problems, probably much more so than the family. Well, the research is starting to show that family members are often showing up for health care long before the alcoholic ever does. They're going in to see the doctor for not being able to sleep, stress, all kinds of things. In children, you may see it take the form of bedwetting, maybe asthma, or any kind of psychosomatic sort of illness. And the health, of the family is really compromised in trying to deal with that situation. So, health problems then is another common, one of the five common symptoms. I want to talk a little bit about the rules in an alcoholic family. I spend more time talking about that in codependency, but basically the rules are like the first one I said, don't talk about it, no talk rule. There's a lot of enabling that goes on, and I define as enabling as not allowing somebody else to experience the consequences of their own behavior. Not allowing somebody else to experience the consequences of their own behavior. There's a lot of rescuing, protecting, covering up, making excuses. And a lot of times families within the family will attack each other for things, but go outside the family and anybody say anything about dad being an alcoholic, and you darn well bet everybody will come to the defense and say, no, that's not so. So there's a lot of enabling going on. There's scapegoating of feelings, blaming on somebody else. I'll talk more about that in the roles. There's often a lot of role reversals. Sometimes you see children becoming parents at a really young age. And you might see the parents almost being parented by the children in some situations. There's a lot of isolation. People are not really connected to one another. There's a lot of mystic building, which I kind of call fantasizing. Sometimes alcoholic children, there's been a lot of education of teachers and school counselors now to the point where they can begin to spot children in schools who may be coming from an alcoholic family. And when you talk to these kids sometimes, what they'll tell you is, oh, our family's just fine. We go to the zoo, we go on picnics, we do all these things, and none of that is really happening, but they'd like to believe it. So there's a lot of mystic building, believing that the family is really close and really a neat family, and then, but the reality is that it might be just so enmeshed, so meshed in that people are not their own separate person. There's a lot of rigidity. When I talk about the mobile being flexible and being able to change and being able to shift and it's okay for people to be different, that's really the case in a healthy family. When alcoholism or a chronic condition comes, people get really locked in to being a certain way and they're not allowed to kind of get out of that and to move into a different kind of role. And it's not okay for you to be different. We all got to think the same and be the same. And so there's a lot of rigidity. There's a lot of rigidity, not room to grow or to, some people say that I'm describing a Lutheran family when I talk about sometimes they can get kind of stoic. Okay. What I want to do now is really begin to talk about each person in the family. And I'm going to describe a mom and a dad and four children. And I know that not all of you came from a family that had a mom and dad and four children. But it's kind of a sample family. And you'll probably see, maybe yourself in more than one of these roles. But these are real common ones, and they're not always distinct. They're not always just separate, and you're only one of these, but rather kind of a combination. And I want you to keep the mobile idea in mind as we talk about what we see that everybody does. Because each person in this family that I'm going to talk about, each six people, are going to bring something to that mobile that keeps it balanced. And maybe the challenge is to figure out what that is. And then it might help you to understand why you see some of the behaviors that you do. I'm going to start out with the chemically dependent person, not because they're the most important, okay? But that's where I'm going to begin. What are some behaviors that you commonly see on the outside for somebody who's chemically dependent? I'm not talking about what's going on the inside for them, but what are some of the things you see on the outside?
They're restless.
Yeah. Can you be more specific about that?
They can't concentrate.
Okay. So maybe difficulty concentrating? Poor concentration. What else?
They want to be the same as other people. They don't want people to know that they are dependent, so they want to try to follow the regular mold of families.
Okay. Now this is
a type of denial, I think.
Yeah, okay. But how do you see that denial? How does it come out? I'm trying to maybe get more specific.
If families go on vacation, this happens. All families go on vacation too because they don't want to be different than other families, even though they don't have.
So it's a big cover up.
They cover it up, yeah. So they
try to look normal.
Yeah, they may run it up on their plastic credit card. But they want to go too because they want to be different than somebody else.
Right.
They don't want to admit that they are real financial problems because of the chemical dependency.
Right. Okay. Now, if we take just the chemically dependent person, I'm trying to get more specific about behaviors that they do.
A lot of anger.
Anger, definitely. Anger and aggression.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about grandiosity in that sense that I can handle everything? I'm in charge. Y'all know what grandiose means?
Yeah.
So you see a lot of grandiose behavior. What else? I used to, what do they always say about people who are drug addicts or alcoholic, that they're good what? Good cover-ups or good con artists, right? Well, I'm not going to use the word conning. I think that's kind of boring. And up until a few years ago, I always used to say manipulative. But I've chosen, I think, another word. For what it's worth, I say that they're charming.
Good talkers.
They get good at charming other people around them to get what they want. And so that really develops in everybody in the family. But they, in an effort to cover up and conceal their disease, and that's maybe the thing that you were getting at, is they get good at charming other people around them. God forbid anybody would find out. You see some righteousness, that they're right all the time. Okay. What else? Anything? How about rigidity? Have to have things my way. Things have to go a certain way.
What did you call it?
Rigidity.
Rigidity, yeah.
And then what's the other thing we see as the disease progresses, that they become less and less what?
Flexible.
Sociable, dependable, responsible. Less responsible. That's
really the key one. And I use that word responsible, not just in terms of handling things, but less responsive to life and people around them. Okay?
There seems to be a greater reaction. People they like, they really bestow upon them all kinds of attention. People they don't like to get very hostile toward.
Right,
The disease progresses.
A real black and white kind of thing. Definitely. And that's maybe part of the rigidity that I was talking about too, and the controlling that somebody else mentioned. I was going to say perfectionism, it kind of comes out a little bit, but that's another one. And then I think one of the things that children often learn real quick is that there's a lot of inconsistency. 1 minute, Grandpa will give me a dollar, and I'm his best friend, and the next minute, he's real ticked off at me. Sort of like unpredictability, inconsistency, and a lot of mood swings. And that, again, may be chemically induced due to the substance that they're using, but you see a lot of mood swings. Now, those are the things you all see going on the outside. What do you think is going on the inside for somebody who's chemically dependent?
Low self-esteem, anger, fright, fear.
Fear? Tremendous amount of fear.
They're very bitter.
Everybody's
to blame for everything that happens except them.
Well, I think the blaming you see on the outside. I'm thinking more of the stuff that you don't know about, what might be going on feeling-wise for the person. Believe it or not, there's a lot of guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. A lot of pain. A lot of hurt. What else? Anything? Those are the feelings.
Oh my gosh.
What I have here are the feelings. Do we have access to that? Do we usually know about that?
No.
The wall, the wall of defense, everything that the person does is really in an effort to not touch those feelings. Let's face it, none of us like to feel those things. And the chemically dependent person will go to great lengths to protect from feeling those feelings. And yet, you know what? Touching those feelings is exactly what gets people into treatment. Now, you might hear about these feelings, maybe like at a state of remorse. Maybe when they're after a hangover, or at a time when they, maybe something has happened, they might kind of cry the next day after. You might have access a little bit to the fact that they might be feeling those things, and they might. But rarely, rarely. And as the disease progresses, this wall gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and they don't have access to those feelings. Okay, yeah.
An alcoholic coming out of, let's say, period of drunkenness, he projects that rejection on other person.
Definitely.
Number one says, I bet you hate me. Saying it over and over again. You know,
yes.
I'm trying to help me. I bet you hate me.
Yeah. And it's all self-hate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Projection. We didn't write that one down, but that's another thing you see on the outside. Kind of it's everybody's fault. And there's a paranoia that goes with the later stage that I talk about in another lecture, where they just have antennas that are way out here, and they just feel like everybody's watching their drinking, nobody likes them, and I'm sure that, you know, the rest of the world is out to get them. And that develops physiologically. There's also a basis for that, in that repeated exposure to alcohol in the central nervous system really caused that. It's like it's kind of like if you see a newborn baby, you know, when they're born and they're laying down and you go like that, what does the baby do? They kind of go like that, right? I mean, the baby doesn't just lay there and go. It's very much like that for a person who has been using sedative alcohol valium downers of any kind. They get, you know, pretty overly reactive to their environment. And we do know that there's some research that suggests that people who become chemically dependent
are actually people who want to experience life in a deeper, richer way. And one of the problems that they have is being able to do that, and to do that without chemicals, because they just really do want to experience life very richly. And that's, I think, one of the joys that I've found in working with people who are recovering, is that quality is beautiful to see. The problem is, though, that with the antennas that are out there than the, further than the general population, is that everything is a big deal. You know, they kind of overly react to everything. And so that's kind of the balance to that. Okay. Now, their wall of defense is covering up all that all of those feelings. So that's the dependent person. The next person I want to talk about is someone we call the chief enabler, the spouse, the parent, the friend, the co-worker, the prime enabler, whatever you want to call this person. And everybody who is chemically dependent has one of these. Sometimes, usually, they have more than one. But the chief enabler is often the spouse or the parent of somebody who's chemically dependent. And they're the person who is closest and most dependent upon by this person. Most dependent upon by that person. And as the illness progresses and grows in the chemically dependent person, so does the involvement of this person. They get more involved in what's happening over here to this person. And with the growth comes a repression of their own feelings and developing their own set of survival defenses. Now, one of the key things you said over here was that this one person becomes less responsible. Keeping the mobile in line, this person's becoming less responsible. What do you think you're going to see this person do?
More responsible.
So chief enablers are usually super responsible. They're the people we often look at sometimes, and they're doing the stuff at church, they're raising all their kids, they probably have two part-time jobs, and they're taking on foster children, you know? They're just always doing, lots and lots of things. And they become, you know, super responsible to the point that, you know, people look at them and say, I don't know how they do it. I just don't know. And on top of that, they live with a drunk, people will say. You know, I don't imagine how they do it. What are some other things that you might think that this person does, some behaviors that you see on the outside, besides that super responsibility? What?
Compulsive behavior.
Yeah, okay. Those five things I mentioned were more unique, or were things that everybody in the family, and I'm trying to get to the more unique things, but definitely there's a lot of compulsion. Their compulsion usually has to do with enabling. They're driven to cover and to protect this person over here. And they'll do that at great cost.
I think that's the number one thing. You're always protecting, and trying to keep everything in the family. Like, I know in my house, I never tell, this is my second husband. My children are by my first husband that died. But when John is drinking or we're having bad times, they call me and say, how are you, Mom? I says, fine. Everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And I'm always covering up for him. Mm-hmm. And I go to church and I'm on everything. Nobody at church knows I got an alcoholic husband. It's like I live two lives, really.
Do you really think that?
My neighbor knows because she's, and I told her, I said, I don't want to spread around church. I'm always protecting him, taking care of him.
And what price has that had on him?
It's had a lot. It drove me right to the point of suicide. And now I'm going to the classes and I'm learning.
That's great.
I can't always get out what I want to say.
I think you're doing fine. You're expressing yourself really well.
See, before I left home, I wanted him to think about what he wanted out of life, because I was going to make some decisions when I got home. If he wants to continue drinking, he can do it. But he isn't going to do it with me there. He's either going to make up his mind what he wants. I says, I'm not telling you what to do. You're an individual. make up your own mind, but I don't have to live with a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't want to change, I'm going to get me an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, nobody's going to tell me I can't drink. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm not telling you you can't drink. I'm just asking you to make a decision if you want me as a wife, mm-hmm. or if you want to be here and mm-hmm. drink all the time.
And then we wonder why, if it's a disease, I mean, the insanity of that, being willing to give up homes and families and everything. And so one of the things, that, another thing that you, I think we see on the, I guess, that you're kind of expressing, is this person does a lot of self-blaming. The fact that you don't want anybody else to know, in some ways, is like, feeling like maybe I'm responsible, and what would those people think if they knew? And so there's a lot of self-blame that goes with being the chief enabler. Oftentimes, they show, despite all of the stuff that they're doing, powerlessness. Oftentimes, people will go to this person and say, why can't you fix this person? Why can't you straighten them out? And they think, oh God, maybe I should, you know? And all the things that they're doing just contribute to that sense of powerlessness. Because obviously they can't. It's like trying to fix somebody, you know, who has diabetes or cancer. And so they end up feeling pretty powerless in the situation. Chief enablers are also pretty serious, usually. They don't have a lot of fun in their life. And obviously this person over here is sometimes saying, come on, why don't you lighten up a little bit? Why don't you have some fun? Why don't you get out there and have a good time? You're always such a bore, you know? And this person is over here thinking of the mobile again. You know, why? Somebody's got to, you know, handle things around here. I've got to take care of this, and I've got to manage our checkbook, and I've got to do this. Somebody has to be serious about life. And so consequently, you know, you see a very serious person. They also demonstrate some self-pity sometimes, and I don't mean this in judgment, I just mean it as a way of surviving. You know, why did I marry that person who didn't drink? You know, poor me, I'm really stuck here, I'm not going to, you know, be able to get out of it. And one of the things I hear you saying is you're kind of challenging your self-pity a little bit and saying, no, I don't have to be stuck here, and this isn't how I have to feel about myself.
Yeah, I'm just learning
that. That's right.
For years,
Yeah. Sometimes they appear fragile. Despite everything that they're handling, they appear fragile. Couldn't possibly ask me to do that. Oh, I couldn't do that. And they're doing all these things. The other thing I mentioned, I said about the person who is chemically dependent, believe it or not, enablers become good charmers too, in the same sense that, you know, you get good at covering up, and so, or may try tactics like, honey, why don't you take the kids with you when you go to the store? What really is the person saying? I don't want you to stop at the tavern, so take the kids with you. You know, rather than being direct, there's sort of that manipulation or that charming. They might call ahead to parties, maybe try to control the alcohol, doing all kinds of acrobats, really, to try to control what's happening to this other person. What do you think their role is in the mobile as far as what they provide? You already kind of...
Balance.
Yeah, but how do they balance it out? Their contribution to the family is responsibility. They're the ones who people really look to. So they provide the responsibility to the family. That's their role. Because as this person loses more and more control in their life, what are you going to see this person doing?
Taking on.
And very often people look at this person and they call them a controller. I mean, they're feeling so out of control in other parts, they become controlling in other ways. And oftentimes people don't like this person. They'll say, God, if I had to live with a bitch like that, I'd drink too. People will say that. And actually what they're seeing are symptoms of the family disease. Those are the consequences of the illness of chemical dependency, not the causes of it. They're not causing this person to drink, despite everything this person might say. Okay.
Usually their friends are disliking. They don't want anybody telling them what to do, so right. They figure the person that has to be responsible is just, you know, giving him a bad time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. The next person I want to talk about are children now. And the first person is someone we call the family hero. It's often, usually the oldest child, so it's usually the person that sort of kind of breaks up that dual relationship that they've had. It's often the oldest child. But the family hero is the person who, in the family, who can see and hear more of what's really happening. And they begin to feel responsible for the family pain. And if only the family would listen to them, they have the answers. They've studied it. They've read about it. And the hero tries really hard to make things better in the family. And they work diligently trying to improve the situation in the family. But do you think they're able to do that? No. And they're always losing ground, and as a result end up feeling tremendously inadequate, because they're trying to fix and improve the family situation. Now, that inadequacy, though, strangely enough, is well hidden by the obvious success of the family hero. Because the family hero is usually the person who is gets good grades in school. They're the person who is captain of the football team, head of the student council, on the honor roll, the one who has a lot of friends. They're really successful. They're also the person who kind of looks like they have it all together. They're often the person who becomes maybe a parent to the younger children at a pretty young age.
Are they driven to overachieve life?
A little bit, yeah they are. Because what do you think their role is in that mobile, balancing things out? What do you think they provide with all that success?
Good feeling to the rest of them.
Exactly. Yeah. Self-worth.
Yeah.
Their role is to provide self-worth for everybody else in the family. Mm-hmm. See, our family's not so screwed up. Look at how good Johnny's doing in school. And so they often are called the special child. And very often, I forgot to talk about the inside feelings of the chief enabler. This person usually confides a great deal in the family hero. Usually they're pretty close. Almost takes on the role of that person.
This one confides in me.
They often develop an independent life away from the rest of the family at a fairly young age. They move away from the family. And of course they move away geographically, but not emotionally. They're the person who is real perceptive to the pain. They're the ones that kind of do things that are right, often perfectionistic. They perform very well. They perform very well. Another thing is that they work hard for approval. This is a role I played in my own family, and sometimes I jokingly tell people that it was almost like I would introduce myself and say, "Hi, my name is Jackie. How do you like me so far?" Because what mattered most was how much you approved of me and liked me. That's what I was always trying to seek, to the point that I got good at what we call impression management. Managing your impression of me was kind of my job. And again, all of that success on the outside is really covering up, what did I say, the big thing on the inside? Feeling greatly inadequate. And also a lot of guilt. Because in some way the family hero does feel responsible for what's going on. They also experience a lot of loneliness, a lot of hurt, pain, and shame. This is the person who the family says, we can be proud of our family. Look what they've done. A research study done a few years ago of, I think I shared this in the codependency lecture, of about 10 medical schools, found that a real high percentage of medical students were family heroes coming out of alcoholic families. And then we wonder sometimes why the medical profession hasn't really understood alcoholism very well. My guess is that probably happens also in the clergy. Because people who are family heroes tend to go into helping professions. I want to back up a minute because I skipped something here. What do you think the big feeling on the inside for the chief enabler is? Some of them.
Rage.
Yeah, anger. Definitely anger and rage.
Mm-hmm.
Hurt and pain. Guilt and shame. Are you beginning to see some similarity?
Yeah.
Things may be the same on the inside, but the outside's different, right? And once again, this person is totally out of touch with these feelings. Call this person angry? I'm not angry. I'm not angry. I can't get angry. Peace at any price. Avoid conflict.
I have a guilty feeling because I feel like I failed because I can't help my husband.
Mm-hmm. And yet, would you feel that way if he developed cancer or diabetes?
No, I'd be there taking care.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like maybe I've done something. Maybe I don't try to get the message across to him to realize what he's doing to himself and his body. And my husband stands 6'2" and weighs 120 pounds. He looks like he's just a walking skeleton with skin on.
Yeah.
And I says, you're killing yourself. If I want to kill myself, I can. He's got an attitude that you just can't. And when he's sober, he's the nicest person you can be around. It's like two different, Jekyll and Hyde. That's the only way I can.
People use that phrase all the time in alcoholism treatment.
He's not a mean alcoholic. Mm-hmm. He doesn't beat you or anything, but I mean, it's what he's doing to his own self that I'm worried about.
Mm-hmm. What do you think happens to chief enablers if they don't get treatment? What happens to chemically dependent people who don't?
They die.
It's a fatal illness. We know that people who are chemically dependent have a shorter lifespan of about 20 years without treatment. What do you think happens to chief enablers? Depression? Suicide?
Physical
illness?
Suicide.
What do we also know about if they don't get treatment? Let's say they divorce this person. What do we often see happen?
They'll remarry.
That's what they say, that you go right.
Without treatment, usually the chief enabler will have another relationship with somebody who's chemically dependent, or develop that same kind of dynamic with their children or with a child or someone they're taking care of. What happens to family heroes without treatment, without help? They tend to become workaholic type people, never like to be wrong. They feel responsible for everything and everybody else. They tend to marry chemically dependent people and take on this responsibility in relationships, kind of take on this role. The other thing we see is they're not as likely to become chemically dependent at a young age, but we do see that probably in their 30s and 40s they end up going in for counseling or help for a lot of depression. they end up feeling like I'm just pooped out. I feel like I have been there for everybody else in my family, and I'm just tired. I'm just tired. And so they're not as likely to become chemically dependent as they are depressed. We also see them having problems sometimes with eating disorders, either compulsive overeating or undereating. With treatment, they can learn to accept failure, that it's okay to make mistakes, that they don't have to be responsible for everybody else, just for themselves. They make good executives. People do like to hire family heroes because they can do a lot of good work. They're usually good organizers. They're often people who went without a childhood. They didn't get to be a little kid. They grew up pretty young. A lot of the needs that they have is that they have to learn how to express their real feelings. They have to learn how to take risks and to be vulnerable because they like to have things go a certain way. Okay. I want to talk about three more children. Can I erase this?
If one of these chemically dependent people just don't want to quit being dependent, is there any self-destruction in that?
You mean in continue? You mean it's like a slow suicide? You mean?
Yeah.
Is continued use of the chemical?
Subconsciously, are they just?
Well, there's been a lot of research done on that, but actually not. I mean, sometimes they'll say alcoholism is a form of slow suicide, but we do know that alcoholic people have a higher rate of suicide. They're more likely to commit suicide than what the general population is. But to say that being alcoholic means you're suicidal.
No, I didn't mean that. If they don't want to go into treatment, if they want to, like the lady's husband says, mm-hmm. I don't want to quit.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, my husband thinks people smoking marijuana and all that stuff, but they're really bad. Mm-hmm. He doesn't consider it alcoholism. He thinks the chemical dependence is mm-hmm. different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what you're asking is because they refuse help or whatever, is it a statement that they really want to die? And I would say no. Mm-hmm. But that refusal is all part of the disease. No. Just in the same way that you might be stubborn sometime about, you know, not wanting to see some part of yourself or deny, the same thing is true for them. It's too painful to admit. It's like a defense, a protection. The next person I want to talk about is a scapegoat. And a scapegoat is the one who is really in the family's public eye. They've already learned in this family that you're not rewarded for who you are as a person, but for how you perform. And no way do they want to perform like the Goody Two-Shoes family hero. And the person doesn't certainly want to work that hard to prove themselves worthy. So they pull themselves away from the rest of the family. And they kind of develop a family and look for those good feelings in their peer group. Their friends kind of in some way become their family. And they look for those good feelings of belonging somewhere else. And because of the repressed anger in feeling the need for this withdrawal, they often get a lot of attention for the destructive things that they do, not for the positive things that they do. And so often that might take have a lot of anger, kind of blame everybody else. And this is the person in the family, folks, that everybody points their finger at and says, if this person would straighten out, our family would be just fine. And oftentimes every family has one of those people. But in a dysfunctional or an alcoholic family, it's really strong. The scapegoat is the person who the family kind of hangs up. They're the problem child. They're the company troublemaker. They're the social jerk. Now, what do you think that they provide in that balance on the mobile? If the enabler provides a responsibility, the family hero provides self-worth, What does this person do for the family?
Someone to blame.
Someone to, yeah. Because who do they take the heat off of? The alcoholic, the person who's chemically dependent. You know, at least they're not looking at me quite so much anymore. You know, they're kind of blaming the kid now. And so what they represent to the family is they provide some distraction from the chemical dependency and a focus. We can focus on that person. You know, and this person in no way wants to compete with the family hero. I could never understand why my sister, who was the scapegoat in our family, just didn't want to have the same friends I did in school, and she didn't want to be a cheerleader, she didn't want to be on the honor roll, she didn't want to be any of the things, and she hung out with the mucky mucks at school. Why couldn't she be like me? Well, we have a great relationship now, thank God, but during that time, you know, she didn't want to compete with me, and her role in the family really was we kind of focused on her a little bit and took the heat off my dad in some ways. Because that's what they provide.